session number 17896, reel 5.
Right, this is General Purden, reel 3. So after Duke of York's barracks.
Yes.
You went to Staff College, is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
Why did you go there? What did you do? What did you learn?
Why did I go there? Because if you were going to get anywhere in the army and become a really professional officer and get any of the good jobs that were going, you had to go to the Staff College. And it actually, frankly, took me 3 attempts to get there. And I always say that I think it was they got used to my writing and let me through out of kindness the 3rd shot. But I got there and it was a wonderful year. You had 3 divisions, A and B division in Camberley itself and C division at Minley, quite near. And we had very good directors of studies who in those days were majors, temporary lieutenant colonel for the period they were instructor at the Staff College. And they were all selected because they're people who were considered would go on in their service. And it was an awful lot done in syndicates, by syndicate discussion, so you learned from each other's experience.
What sort of problems were you faced with, though, I mean, in a syndicate? What situations were you put into?
Well, you'd be put into a situation of any of the 4 phases of war, or logistic problems, or communication problems, and you could be given the job of anyone from the divisional commander to a staff captain, and you took it in turns to have those particular jobs, and you would have you would discuss the principles of the phase of war. The next thing you would do would probably write an exam on it. Then you would be given a cloth model demonstration where all the directing staff would have, they would sort of dress up, one would dress up as the divisional commander and so on. One would be the gunner and the Royal Signals and Sapper and so on. You'd then go out on the ground and do a tactical exercise without troops. And during that toot, you would be, for part of it, you might be the divisional commander, part of it you might be brigade major of a brigade that was taking part. And
this would be in a room, in a building?
No, the toot would be outside. You'd be on the ground and you would walk. You would, at occasions, if it was an attack, you might well walk the attack. I mean, there'd be no guns firing, anything like that. We might be around on Barossa, around Sandhurst. I remember one area was Dummer, in Hampshire, near Andover, Basingstoke, that's right. You'd also pay visits to Royal Air Force stations, Royal Naval ports. There were 6 terms. When I first went there, you could be sacked at any time. And we had General Sir Charles Jones, as he later became. He was then a Major General, as our commandant. And at the end of the first term, 3 chaps were given the sack. And we were all a bit shaken by this because
shot from the course.
Just that's it, yeah, finish. And there's a very big lecture hall called the Rawlinson Hall, and he assembled us all in there, and he said, "Now look, 3 people have gone, and I have decided that no one else is going to be sacked during the course. So what I want you to do is to enjoy the course, work hard to improve yourselves as professional officers." And that was that. And so we then had that tension removed from us by this splendid man.
Again, did you have aspects of military history that you took on board? I mean, for instance...
Yeah, we did.
Did you learn about Blenheim? And
no, not as far back as that.
It's not really applicable.
No, I seem to remember it was mainly the Second World War. Mm. Things like Operation Epsom, Operation Goodwood, you know, that sort of thing. logistics in Burma. We went over to Normandy and did a battlefield tour where we had guest artists. For example, a chap who commanded a tank troop. There was a company commander from the Argylls, and they would actually point out where their slit trenches had been in their company. Yes, it was. We were put up in a school there. The officers, directing staff and so on were in rather nice hotels, just what you were saying. We were in a girls' hotel in dormitories, but girls' school, but the girls, of course, weren't there. And I think it was about a week or 10 days we were over there. It was very useful indeed.
And did you have to cover scenarios, for instance, of the existing Cold War? I mean, a Warsaw Pact breakthrough over the North German plains and things like that, or was this something you talked about endlessly, I'd imagine, did you?
I honestly can't remember that. I know that when I was chief instructor at Warminster, we did, but I cannot remember. I suppose we must have covered it. Yes, we did. We did the organization of the Russian army and how they operated and so on. But you see, most of us were thinking in those days we'd still got active service going, and we were all hoping, well, I certainly was, that I was going to get somewhere where there was active service on. Therefore, one was concentrating more on what was going on in Malaya, what was going on in Kenya, you know, what was going on in Cyprus, that sort of thing. But I think they covered the spectrum of everything the British Army could be involved in. And we were there for the year. And that was followed by a 3-month course at the Royal Military College of Science at Shrivenham, where one dealt with the technical side of things. At that stage, General Sir Charles Richardson, as he later became, was the commandant there, and he was another very good man. And really, I've no comments to make on the time at Shrivenham. I imagine
a bit about the hardware, was it?
I think it. Yes, that's right. We went round factories, you know, making that made army equipment and so on, and guns and all that.
But essentially, it trained you for moving into the ranks of generals. And,
I wouldn't have said that any of us thought of a question of being trained to move into the ranks of generals. What we trained to be really is you hope to be a grade 2 staff officer when you left the place.
Some could be any rank, presumably. I
mean, no, grade 2 staff officers are major.
So when you
left the staff college, I think probably most of us got grade 2 jobs, although some people, in fact, one chap came as my staff captain to Malaya, to Singapore. And yet he was an extremely able gunner officer. But there just weren't enough jobs to go around. But no, you thought of that, really. I never thought of being a general. Never. Not then, no.
But, you know, the further you get up, of course,
yes.
The narrower
the nearer you get. Yes, the nearer you get to it,
yes.
Then you do think about it. But my ambition had always been to command my regiment. That's what I wanted to do.
And so once you graduated there, you went to Colombo, was that just...
Oh, no, that was just... We just got off the boat at Colombo
boat, yes.
With friends, yeah.
And off to Malaya.
Yes.
Now, the campaign was still going on then?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we were... It was still going on, and it went on, in fact, until... I think Merdeka Freedom came maybe just before we came home.
Merdeka
was freedom. Yes. That was when Malaya became independent. And we really couldn't give them their independence until we'd won the war. And the Malayan army was all set up and ready to motor.
Because Templar was doing his work out there in the late 40s, wasn't he?
No, Templar...
Fortified villages and...
Templar went out... was it the late 40s? It might have been. It might have been, yes. He had been and gone anyway by the time we went there. My boss was, our overall boss was General Sir Charles Loewen, who was a Canadian. Very nice man. And then Field Marshal Frankie Festing took over from him. He was a great man. And General Sir James Castles was commanding in Malaya, who'd been my general in Palestine.
Now, you write very vividly about going on patrol to familiarise yourself with the jobs that your men have to do.
Yes.
Now, this was a technique, presumably, that had developed out of the war in Burma, had it, fighting in jungle situations?
Yeah.
You'd covered that, presumably, in your training in the past, I mean, at Staff College and places like that. Have you warfare techniques?
No. No, they didn't get down to that. When you went to Malaya, if you were going to a fighting formation, mind you, I went to General Headquarters, which was not a fighting formation, you went to the Jungle Warfare School at Kota Tinggi, and there you were put through all the techniques of operating in the jungle, fighting in the jungle. And the man, really, who set it all up was General Sir Walter Walker, when he was a lieutenant colonel, having commanded not only a Gurkha battalion in Borneo, in Burma, he then commanded a Gurkha battalion in the Malayan Emergency, where I think he got his second DSO, and then he set up the Jungle Warfare School. So it all really goes back to General Walter Walker, and it was very, very thorough and gave you great confidence.
Now, presumably on those patrols, the enemy was more concerned in keeping out of your way than being actively opposed.
At that stage, yes. Mind you, if you were casual, he'd have you. Even 56, 57, 58, no question about it, there were still ambushes. And you know, you've got some regiments that were sloppy, undoubtedly, British. And you've got others that, if you looked alert, this is a thing I learnt, because my attachment to the South Wales Borderers, they were a super battalion, a wonderful commanding officer, Richard Myers. But you would always see them looking as if you dared to attack them, they would kill you immediately. You know, that was the way, if you looked alert and aggressive, the CTs wouldn't dream of touching you. Whereas if you were sloppy, you were leaning, communist terrorists, you're leaning back in your car or in your vehicle, or you know, or you weren't looking aggressive, then that's the sort of unit that invited action against it.
Of course, in a sense, it's the blind fighting the blind in those situations. But presumably, you have to learn, you know, the basic things like how to move without making noises.
As much as possible without making noise.
Without leaving a trail.
Yes, that's right. Oh, very much so. It was so easy to follow people, you know, if they were careless. And, of course, it all depended really on intelligence. And if you had a good special branch, then you were going to inflict casualties on the... Provided you were good at moving in the jungle, provided you could shoot straight.
Now, the anti-terrorist campaign in Malaya was a success in the sense that the CTs were taken out and Malaya became independent as Malaysia.
Yes.
Now, the other situation was, of course, Vietnam, where the local forces, the Viet Cong, had a greater grasp of jungle warfare than the Americans. Did you study the Vietnam War in detail, and did you learn much from it?
No, we didn't at all, actually. I personally have always felt that as the Americans had shown solidarity with us, we should have gone to Vietnam. We should have maybe had a Commonwealth Division or something, because you see the Australians and the New Zealanders went there. We didn't. I was selected to be a G1 out there, and then...
G1 being what?
Staff officer grade one, you know, having commanded a battalion in Borneo, selected for a grade one job. There were very, very few British people there, and I can't remember whether I was going to be at the embassy or what, but it was suddenly cancelled, and I was made chief instructor at the School of Infantry. I'm jumping ahead, I'm afraid, on this. But I remember that at the end of the Borneo campaign, I, a Gurkha, an Australian, the three of us were given the job of writing a pamphlet on lessons learnt in the Borneo campaign. And I came back out to Malaya, I was based at the Jungle Warfare School at Kota Tinggi, and we wrote this between us. And one night, we went out together, and we were having dinner together, and the Aussie turned to me and he said, tell me why you people are yellow. And I said, what in God's name do you mean? Because he'd been in Borneo with me, and he was SAS, Australian SAS. And he said, well, you Limeys won't come and fight in Vietnam. We came to you in Malaya, we came to you in all the wars, and you haven't come to us. And I felt really bloody, because I think that the area that we would have been given out there, we'd have done it jolly well, because I really reckon we had tremendous expertise working in the jungle. I'm not talking about the political situation. I don't understand that. I don't think any country would have beaten them without dropping atom bombs on them or something. I wouldn't like to hazard anything about that. I'm not qualified to talk about that. But I do believe that if we had gone out as a Commonwealth Brigade or a Commonwealth Division with British representation as well, that we would have done bloody well in the area that we had. And I've always regretted we never went there.
Of course, the Americans learned a lot of lessons from the Malaysian campaign, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Fortified villages.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yes, they did. Yeah.
But I just feel that the political tide was against anyone who supported South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. That's quite true. Yeah.
Came from the north.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you're quite right.
The domino effect didn't materialize. Yeah.
No, it didn't. No, absolutely, no. No, I mean, much earlier on, we might have had friends there. In the same way, we antagonized the Chinese when we'd had the Americans did, having had a mission out there with them, in which a friend of mine was commissioned into the Nationalist Army.
An
American.
Chiang Kai-shek,
He was working with him first, but he then worked with Mao Tse-tung.
Did he?
Yes, with what was called the Dixie Force or something. And this chap, Johnny Colling, was with them. And they came back, and they knew exactly how they thought. They'd made an awful lot of friends. Mao was a personal friend of his. So was Chiu and Lai. And at that time, they had this anti-red campaign in America. And he sent all his notes on communist tactics, on personalities and so on. He sent it to the Pentagon. And he got it back, I think, 2 years ago, and it was unopened.
Really? Mm. Yeah.
And he's written a book on it, which I've got here. Mm. What it was, that instead of being frightened of them, if we'd gone on and made allies of them, even though they were communists, there's no reason why you couldn't have a communist ally, I don't think, really, provided he doesn't try and make you a communist. And I think the same thing happened. Although we trained South Vietnamese officers at our jungle warfare school, we trained Thai officers, and no doubt NCOs as well. But it was such a tiny proportion out of the army. There's really not very much we could do. We could give them British techniques. No doubt when they got back, they said, oh, well, we prefer the American techniques or we prefer our own techniques. No, you're quite right. It was bloody stupid to ever get involved out there at all.
Part of what the historian Barbara Tuchman called the March of Folly.
Yeah, well said.
The theory of which is if you're in a hole, keep digging.
Yes.
You didn't go to Korea.
No.
The Korean War.
No, I wish I had. No.
I mean, that was a case where we did go in.
Yes.
With the Australians.
And we did bloody well.
And particularly on the sides of the units.
Yeah, my battalion was there, and unfortunately I was in Egypt, and I didn't get there. And I regret it. I'll regret it to the day I die.
Because going back also to the Second World War, I mean, the way fate works, it could well be that if you weren't captured at Saint-Nazaire, you might not have survived the war.
Well, we've often talked about this, those of us who were there, and I was saying to a great friend of mine, when D-Day was being done, I said, I wish to God I'd been at D-Day. And he said to me, you know, if we had got back, we'd have probably been dead long before D-Day. But you never think you're going to be.
Might have gone to the Dieppe.
Might have done. My, I don't know what would have happened. My commando was eventually broken up, number 12, and people went to the other commandos. I don't know why. But anyway, that's water under the bridge, isn't it?
Okay, from the Far East you went to Cyprus?
Yes, I did. While I was out there, I wrote to the commanding officer of the 1st Battalion and said, look, I've got 4 months' leave. Could I spend it in the battalion? Have you got a job for me? And he wrote back and said, well, in fact, I've got a spare company. Would you come and command it? So we were using a support company as a rifle company, because in that situation you'd no need for support weapons. And so we were just doing an ordinary infantry company job. So I had 4 months of the same sort of activity as one had in Cyprus, or these in Malaya. We were chasing these Aoka gangs, and they would operate sometimes at night. The church bells would ring, and you'd go to the churchyard, and you'd find some unfortunate informer lying dead inside the churchyard. And they go around and paint on the roads and paint on the walls, Enesis and Brits out and all the usual things. And so we operated really by short, what we call soft shoe patrolling. We blacked our faces and arms, and we wore gym shoes, and we moved at night. And we'd go into cafes and things like that and make everyone show their means of identity to us. And we would do ambushes on possible Aoka rendezvous, and we'd do the odd snatch. You know, your special branch would tell you that there was going to be a meeting of a particular Aoka group in a particular house in a particular village. And the question was to get there at night quietly and surprise them. And I do describe in my book one particular operation we did, which was 25% successful. But really, then the Turks were our friends, and the Aoka were not, of course. That lasted for 4 months. And then I went back and commanded my depot. Well, the great thing about it was, having operated as a company commander for 4 months, and it was really quite an unpleasant atmosphere if you were in places like Varosha or Nicosia. I mean, you know, they really did not like us, the Greek Cypriots.
Was it a bit like the canal zone or whatever?
Yeah, well, worse, quite honestly. I mean, and they were shooting people in the back and so on. I know I went up with my colonel to my second in command to Nicosia, where he was going to buy a car, and it was really very unpleasant atmosphere, just the pair of us walking around there. But anyway, by the time I got back to the depot, you see, where I was responsible for training recruits who would eventually go out to the battalion in Cyprus, I knew what was wanted, which was terrific. So my 4 months were very well spent as far as I was concerned.
I mean, was your ultimate objective to capture Grievous?
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, I thought, as I said in my book, I thought I'd got him on my way to the airport coming back. But so many of these priests looked the same.
Yeah.
So I did that for... I was
so
there...
Are you referring to Makarios or Grievous?
Oh, sorry, Makarios.
Yes.
No, Grievous, yes. Grievous, I think I'm right in saying, was not in Cyprus at that time. I think he was resting in Greece or doing something, because I don't really remember being switched on to him, but I was switched on to Makarios. And we had little identification books, you know, full of photographs of all the wanted people. And so, you know, you would drive along beside them in your Land Rover if anyone looked a bit strange. And you certainly made them look very uneasy as, you know, looked at your book and looked at them and looked at your book and looked at them and turned over the pages. But that, there were some very good men operating there too, you know. In those days, we got our information rather more robustly than we're allowed to do nowadays. I had a particular friend whose name I won't mention, who was not living all that far from here, and I hadn't met him since Malaya. And he was always... I used to say to him, what do you do? Do you beat them up? What in God's name do you do? You always get the information. He said, they're no worse off when I finish with them than after a good game of rugger. terrible nowadays, I know. So I then had...
They used to use unpleasant sounds.
What?
Unpleasant sounds, high-pitched sounds.
And that I...
They'd have them straddled against a wall with a sound in their ears or something.
I never honestly ever have heard about that.
Interrogation techniques I've heard about.
Oh, no, the one I knew of was putting a towel over someone's head and tying his hands behind his back and standing him under a shower. And the awful thing is that you, I tried it myself, and you breathe in the towel, you know, you find you can't breathe, you know. Of course, you can go down on your knees, but on the other hand, you can be tied up, so you can't do that. And I think that was one of the techniques they used. But when your men's lives are at stake, provided you don't kill them, provided you don't maim them, and I would certainly object to beating them up, but if you can get information out of them, you're not allowed to nowadays anyway.
Well, it's a situation that you, as a soldier, are faced with, but which the politicians can walk away from.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, they're the people who set up the situation.
I know, and we are servants of the politicians.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But they've really made it awfully difficult for us in all the countries, like Northern Ireland as well. I mean, if we operated the way we would operate, we would not be brutal, and I think you know that. We would not be brutal. But we do feel that our hands are terribly tied regarding getting information, getting good information. I mean, no one's going to tell you, look at these IRA chaps. They just laugh at you. They know the moment you've captured them, they're an automatic folk hero. And then they go off to a prison camp where they've got absolutely everything. Television, education, courses.
And they run the guards.
And they run the guards and they run the camp. But anyway,
was a sad thing. I mean, I think you can look on Malaya as being a positive job that you've done.
Yes, it was.
A stable, independent
country. That's right.
Cyprus, you were really fighting a rearguard action.
We were.
Ultimately, Makarios was going to be president.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, they haven't got a yoke, they've got an independent republic. But then in its place, they've got a divided island.
Yes.
That must have been very sad. I mean, when you left Cyprus, the yoke campaign was still going.
Yes, sadly it was, yeah.
It's Harding who...
Yes, that's right. Harding would be...
But then you were exposed to that situation, and then the vagaries of the army are such that you're posted somewhere else where you're needed.
Yes.
And that was what? Back to...
Went to my regimental depot for 2 years at Ballymena, where we had the IRA threat there.
Yes.
And we had to have the entire perimeter wired, floodlit. We had to have dogs, and we had a ferried scout car with a searchlight, which patrolled at different times throughout the night. You had a machine gun post covering the entrance to the camp passes. Excuse me. I'm so sorry. Some of the men you were recruiting from the south, you would be told that there was a danger that you might have a chap who was coming up to get his military training and then would desert and go to the IRA.
Take a weapon with him?
Try to, but no hope, I'm glad to say. Not with the, certainly not with the arrangements we had in my depot. And that's not, I didn't institute them. I take no credit for it, but one of my predecessors had got everything worked out so well. I mean, of course, they were kept in an armory, they were signed out, they were signed in, and you were bloody well watched. Any rounds you fired, all the rounds were checked. The empties, you had to hand in your empties. It was meticulously careful. And again, a number of us had served, you see, in internal security situations, so we really all were trained. We knew what to do. It was only the recruits who had to be trained. But it did give an additional dimension out there because, it wasn't like sitting in England. The Irish Fusiliers, you see, had a bomb in their depot. And a friend of mine who was commanding their depot got a George Medal. He carried it out on his knee in a car with his adjutant driving. And it exploded. They put it in a field and it blew up, and the adjutant got an MBE. So, I mean, there was a real security situation there then.